It's nice for me just to be able to talk to anybody about this new book because it took me 6 years to report and write. I visited 21 states in my reporting, talked to hundreds of young people, students, high school students, college students, as well as experts and administrators and researchers, educators of all kinds. And the questions that I was trying to answer with this book all had to do with the intersection of these two great forces in American life: higher education and social mobility. And not that long ago, the way those two forces intersected in this country was pretty straightforward. Higher education was the great engine of social mobility. It was the force that most reliably could help young people rise from poverty to the middle class and from the middle class to affluence. But now that engine has in many ways broken down. And when you talk to young people today, especially young people who are growing up without a lot of family resources, what they tell you more often is that higher education feels like the obstacle to their social mobility, like the barrier between them and their dreams. So what I tried to do in the years that matter most is try to understand what went wrong, why that engine broke down, to tell the stories of some young people who are in the middle of that system, and then to start to think about what we all might do to improve things, to change things. So I'm going to talk for about 25 minutes, and then I'm looking forward to a conversation, to answering any questions that I can, but also hearing from you all about how these questions are playing out here in Bozeman and in Montana. But I want to start off with a story, and it is the story that I begin the book with. It takes place on a park bench in a park in West Harlem called St. Nicholas Park. And a couple of years ago, on a cold March afternoon, I came up out of the subway into this park to meet a young woman, a high school senior from a high school around the corner, who I had met a couple of times before, a woman named Shannon Torres. And Shannon, when I'd met her before, had always been this very sort of cool and collected young woman. She was Dominican American. She grew up in the South Bronx. She had this kind of combination skate punk science nerd vibe that I found very intimidating. But on this particular day, sitting on the bench, she was not cool or collected at all. She seemed anxious and nervous. And when I asked her to explain why, she explained that it was March the 30th at 4:15 p.m. And at 5 p.m. on March the 30th, all of the Ivy League colleges simultaneously release all their acceptances and rejections. And Shannon had applied to two Ivy League colleges, Princeton and the University of Pennsylvania. And Penn was her dream school. It was the place she wanted to go more than anywhere else. It was the thing she wanted in life more than anything else. And in 45 minutes, she would find out if her dream would come true or not. And so as we sat there on the bench together, she was kind of coming unglued before my eyes. Her hands were trembling. There were tears in her eyes even before she got any news. And when I asked her to talk about what she was feeling, she said it felt like she had been working her whole life for this one thing. And in some ways she had. She was this remarkable student. In her high school in West Harlem, there was a list posted in the front hall of the school of the top scoring students, the students with the highest grades in every class, every semester. And her very first semester in freshman year, she was at the very top of her class's list, and she had stayed at the top through for every semester after that. In 4 years of high school, she hadn't missed a single day. And despite all that, she wasn't one of these sort of grade-obsessed grinds. She really loved learning. She loved school. She loved science, especially. She wanted to be a paleontologist. But she also loved books. She loved literature. Her favorite book, she told me, was Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which at that point I had tried to read three times and had never made it past page 25. And when you are a young person like Shannon, and you have those sorts of skills and that kind of work ethic, at a certain point, people start talking to you about college. And they say, you could go anywhere. You could go to any Ivy League college you want. And at first, that seemed like a crazy idea to Shannon because no one in her family had ever been to college. Not many people in her neighborhood in the South Bronx had graduated from college. But as time went on, it started to seem more and more plausible. But as it got more and more real, this idea, she also felt the weight of people's expectations on her. And that, she said, was what was really bearing down on her the most on this particular afternoon. She said she could imagine going home and telling her mom that she'd gotten into Penn and seeing the smile on her mom's face. But she said she could also imagine walking through that door and telling her mom that she hadn't got in and seeing the look of disappointment, and then going to school the next day and telling all of her friends who were all pulling for her that she hadn't gotten in and seeing their disappointed faces and being comforted all day. And if there was one thing she hated, it was being comforted. And all of this pressure for her was coming down to this one moment. Now, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to tell you what happens at the end of that chapter. I don't want to spoil chapter one for you, but it is in the book. But what is important to me about that story is not so much what happens at the end. It's the pressure that Shannon felt. And when you are the adult in this situation with a young person, whether a family member or a stranger, rich or poor, who is freaking out about college, you're supposed to say, you know, it's okay. Don't worry about it. College doesn't really matter. You'll be fine no matter what happens. And for some young people, that is true. You know, for affluent students, where you go to college doesn't matter all that much. The problem was, I had just gotten back from California. I'd come right off the plane to this park bench, and I had been in California doing a different part of the reporting for this book. I had been embedded in the lab of an economist at Stanford University named Raj Chetty. And Raj Chetty is now one of the best known and most influential economists in the country, and he is part of this movement in economics called Big Data. These economists who look at giant data sets and use them, analyze them, chop them up to try to understand different phenomena in American life. And the phenomenon that Raj Chetty and his colleagues cared about the most was social mobility. And he and his colleagues had just released this paper called the Mobility Report Cards that for the first time had really analyzed, using IRS records databases going back generations, they had analyzed how individual families rose and fell in the American economy and the role that higher education played. And what he found is that for students like Shannon, college really could make a huge difference. Going to a more selective college would mean more earnings in adulthood. And he also found that when two students come out of the same institution, their adult earnings are almost exactly the same, even if they come from very different backgrounds. So you have a wealthy kid here and a child who grew up in poverty down here. They go to the same institution, and that gap between them is almost entirely closed in just 4 years. So in some ways, that seems like a happy story about higher education and social mobility, right? Like, college works. If Shannon got to Penn or to Princeton, it would work for her. The problem is, Raj Chetty also found that young people like Shannon almost never get to those institutions. He was able to analyze the student bodies of each different American college and university and see what percentage of the student body came from which economic quintile, the wealthiest, the poorest, and all of the quintiles in between. And at Princeton, he found just 2.2% of the student body comes from that bottom quintile. At Yale, it's just 2.1%. So no wonder Shannon was feeling so anxious. Now, of course, Shannon is a rare case. She was the very top of her class, and the Ivy League is a small sliver of the higher education landscape. But the inequities that Raj Chetty found at those institutions have echoes throughout the higher education system. At the most selective schools that spend the most on their students, that produce the best outcomes, there are very few low-income students. And at the public institutions that educate most American college students, and especially most low-income American college students, there were fewer resources, less funding, lower graduation rates, and less public support. But there were some institutions that I encountered in my reporting that felt different, that felt more hopeful. And the ones where I had that feeling were all public institutions. The one where I spent the most time in my reporting was the University of Texas in Austin. And UT is an unusual place. It is a flagship public university. And over the past couple of decades in most states, flagships have really changed. You can tell me whether this is true in Montana, but in most flagships, there's a lot less public funding than there was two decades ago. And so because they need tuition dollars, they've changed the way they admit students. They act more like private colleges. They bring in more out-of-state students. They focus more on test scores in admissions. They bring in more affluent students and fewer low-income students. But over the same period, the University of Texas went the opposite direction. That's because of this law that passed about 20 years ago in Texas called the top 10% rule. And it's now more like the top 6% rule. And what this law says is that the University of Texas at Austin has to admit you if you are in the top 6% of your high school graduating class by GPA, by your course grades. And so that leads to an unusual sort of freshman class each year. You know, if you're in the top 6% of your school and you live in a wealthy suburb of Dallas, you are just like those kids who have high test scores and go to highly selective private institutions or state flagships. But UT also has to admit students who are in the top 6% of a high school in some ranching community in far remote West Texas. They also admit students in the top 6% of their class in high schools in the Rio Grande Valley, where almost every student is Latino or Latina. And they admit the top 6% of students at high schools in inner city Houston. And so all of these students come together each fall in Austin. And they have certain things in common. They're all Texans. They're all great students who are at close to the top of their class. But they also have a lot of differences, certainly in terms of their family resources, their family background, the resources that their schools had. Some of their schools had tons of AP classes. Some had almost none. And there's also a big variation, much more so than at any other state flagship, in terms of their SAT scores, because UT can't look at your SAT score when they're deciding whether to admit you. So there are some students, more often from the wealthy schools, that have really high test scores, and other students, more often from the poorly resourced schools, that have really low SAT scores. And for a long time, those gaps led to big differences in success rates, in graduation rates. And for a long time, UT, like many American institutions of higher education, decided it didn't really care about those gaps. I think a lot of educators, a lot of higher education officials have long thought that it wasn't really their job to help students graduate, that you do that in high school, but in college, you just sort of offer the education and students either accept it or they don't. And if they don't, it means they weren't meant to be there in the first place. But then a few years ago, UT decided to try something different. They decided to try to actually help their students graduate. They named this chemistry professor named David Lotti to be graduation rate champion. They gave him a bunch of money, and he had a job that in 5 years he had to improve the four-year graduation rate at UT from 50%, where it stood at the time, to 70%. That's a pretty big leap for 5 years. And David Lotti did an unusual thing when he got this job. He decided to focus on the students who were graduating at the lowest rates. So instead of focusing on the sort of low-hanging fruit, he focused on those students from the Rio Grande Valley and inner city Houston and West Texas, the students who had the lowest SAT scores, first-generation students, students of color, low-income students. And the question he asked was, well, what if we actually made those students feel welcome? What if we made those students feel like they could succeed at UT? And so he created some programs. Nothing too radical. He started a summer program right before freshman year for first-generation students to help introduce them to the university. He created a freshman learning community so that especially low-income first-generation students all through freshman year had a place to learn about how the college worked and to create a sense of community. They did internships in sophomore and junior and senior year that wove them more into the community of UT. He called it the kitchen sink approach. He just put handholds all over the place that students could grab onto when they didn't feel like they could persist at UT. All of these handholds sent students the message, you can succeed here. You belong here. And things changed. The four-year graduation rate did go up from 50% to 70%. And the biggest gains were among the students who had been doing the worst. So students who had the lowest SAT scores at UT, their four-year graduation rate went up from 39% to 63% graduating on time. And what David Lotti did and what University of Texas did had its roots in this new school of psychology about student mindset that's led by researchers at Stanford University. And the underlying thesis is that there are these moments of transition in life where we get really confused about who we are. And the freshman year of college is definitely one of them. But there are others, like the first time when you have your first child, when you move to a new city, when you start a new job. All of these things make us confused about who we are. And we look for signals in the environment around us for to tell us, like, can we belong here? Can we fit in here? Can we succeed here? And what this theory says is that, you know, there are lots of signals, especially for a freshman in college, that tell you you do belong or you don't belong. You know, you get a bad grade on a test, you get a good grade on a test. Your professor says something nice, your professor says something mean, you have a fight with your roommate, you get along with your roommate. And all of these signals in the mind, especially of first-generation college students, are amplified and turn into either a really good story or a really bad story. So the downside of this theory is that when students, especially first-generation college students, are getting a lot of negative messages in freshman year, they're likely to take them way too seriously and to take them as a signal that things won't ever get better for them and drop out. But it also means that these students are susceptible to more positive messages and that the right message at the right time can make a big difference. And the place in my reporting where I saw this most vividly was in a freshman calculus class at the University of Texas. There is a whole chapter in the book about this freshman calculus class, which is not usually something you say to someone when you want them to buy your book. But it was actually, it's my favorite book chapter in the book, and it was my favorite experience as a reporter while I was working on this book, even though I still don't know calculus. But I did learn a lot about student psychology and about teaching, and that was largely because of the man who led this class, a legendary math educator named Uri Treisman. So he's in his 70s now. He's been teaching calculus for a long time, and he has all sorts of interesting techniques and tricks. But a lot of what makes him so good is that he is finely attuned to students' psychology. Most of the students in his section are first-generation students, low-income students, those students from the less well-resourced high schools. And he pays a lot of attention to how they feel and what they're experiencing. And a lot of that has to do with his own background. So he grew up in a very different kind of community, but with a lot of the same sorts of feelings. He grew up in Jewish immigrant post-war Brooklyn, the sort of intellectual hothouse of that era that all of these amazing minds came out of. And he was a great mathematician, even in elementary school and middle school, but he always felt like he couldn't keep up with his peers. He had what psychologists sometimes call imposter syndrome, this sense that you don't really belong. And so even though he was doing great, he was taking graduate courses at City College during high school, he was the president of the math club at his school, he didn't believe that he could really succeed as a mathematician. And so after high school, he didn't go to college at all. He became a landscaper in Los Angeles, and he just turned his back on math and on academia and spent a lot of time mowing lawns. And then his landscaping company got a contract to cut the lawns at a community college in Los Angeles. And he took to having his lunch outside the portable trailer where they were teaching freshman math. And he would sort of sit there eating his sandwich and listening to the sounds of math come out the open windows. And he sort of remembered what it felt like to do math. And then the professor saw him sitting there and invited him in, and he started eating his lunch inside. And the professor said, so do you know any math? Do you like math? And Uri had to admit that he had actually taken advanced graduate level math at City College. And this professor took him under his wing, brought him back into the community of math, made him feel that he belonged and could succeed. And he finished at community college, went to UCLA, went off to get his PhD at Berkeley, and became a mathematician and a math educator. But he never forgot that feeling of self-doubt. And he recognized it in so many of his students, and he tried to figure out how to help them. So one of the students in his class was a young woman named Yvonne Martinez. And she grew up, she was born in Mexico, and when she was 5, she and her family moved to San Antonio, Texas. And she grew up in a really low-income neighborhood. Her mom was cleaning people's houses. Her dad was working in a warehouse. None of them spoke English when they first got there, but they thought there was more opportunity for them on the American side of the border. So they stayed, made it through all of those hardships. And in fact, she and both of her older siblings all did great in high school. When she finished high school, she was second in her class. And so she, because of the top 6% rule, she was automatically admitted to UT. But she was one of those students who had a relatively low standardized test score. She had a 22 on the ACT, which is scored out of 36. So it was above average, but only a little above average, and not the kind of score that usually leads to success in freshman calculus. And in class, she felt like the other students were all better prepared. She was getting a lot of these signals that she couldn't keep up, that she wasn't really part of the crowd. A lot of calculus students, I didn't know this before I did this reporting, have already taken calculus in high school. And in college, they're just taking the class again. That was not true of Yvonne. And so her self-doubt grew and grew. And she was hearing these positive things from her professor, from Uri Treisman, saying that she was going to do well, things were really going to turn around for her. But then she would get one bad grade after another on a test. And each time after she got a bad grade, she'd go home to the apartment that she shared with her older sister, who was a senior at UT at the time. And she would collapse on the couch and cry. And her sister would come over and put her arm around her and say, "That's okay. You know, it's normal that you're not doing well in calculus. We're poor Latinas from the west side of San Antonio. We never do well in advanced math," which is not actually what the psychologists recommend that you say to somebody in that situation. But somehow for Yvonne, sitting there with her sister's arm around her on the couch, it felt reassuring. It felt comforting. But she still had this question. She was hearing one thing from her sister, another thing from her professor, and she couldn't figure out whether she could really succeed in this class. She hit this low moment right before the second midterm. She was hoping that things were going to turn around. But that morning, the calculus was just as confusing as ever. And she was sitting outside the class with tears in her eyes. And her TA, this woman named Erica, came up and said, "Maybe we should go talk. You don't look very happy." And they did. They both described this conversation to me later. They had this big conversation, and Yvonne sort of for the first time let out all of her fears that she had been feeling, and this idea that it wasn't just this class and it wasn't just this exam, it was her, that she couldn't possibly succeed in at a place like UT, in a city like Austin, that she had thought that higher education was going to level the playing field, but she realized now that it wasn't going to. And Erica found this way to send her a message that kind of bridged the gap between what she was hearing from her sister and what she was hearing from Uri Treisman. Erica had been a first-generation college student as well. She was white Anglo, but she came from this working-class family. And she had really struggled in college, but then had gone on and got a degree in math as well. And so she said to Yvonne, "You know, a lot of what your sister is telling you is true. The system really is unfair. You really are at a big disadvantage. You really are behind where so many other students in this class are." But then she said, "But that is not really who you are. Who you really are is a mathematician. You can succeed in this class. You just have to do things differently. And if you want to try, I'm here to help you." And that somehow changed things for Yvonne. She had in the past been really scared of sort of putting herself out there and trying difficult questions and raising her hand and speaking up in class and being exposed as a fraud and a failure and an imposter. But now she started actually diving into the lessons and raising her hand and trying to answer things and struggling through questions in a way that she hadn't before. And something started to click. And calculus started to make sense. And it turned around. And on the final exam, she got an A. She became a math major. She's now a junior at UT. She's still a math major. And she's back as a tutor in Uri Treisman's freshman calculus class, helping students like her who are struggling through freshman calculus. Now, there is a big debate in higher education these days over whether students like Yvonne can really succeed at rigorous universities like UT. You know, like a lot of low-income students at UT, Yvonne had excellent grades, but only average test scores. And there are a lot of people who trust that test score when they're looking at a student more than they trust the GPA. They think that a student with a 22 ACT can't possibly succeed in a class like Uri Treisman's. This man named Mitch Daniels, who is the president of Purdue University and used to be the governor of Indiana, he wrote an op-ed just as I was writing this chapter about Yvonne and Uri and Erica. And he said it was dangerous in this op-ed. It was dangerous to admit students like Yvonne, not just dangerous for institutions like Purdue, but dangerous for Yvonne. The way he wrote it, here's the quote from this op-ed. He said, "Accepting a high school A at face value and enrolling a student in a calculus course beyond his or her capabilities does the student a serious disservice by risking an avoidable failure. So he was talking about Yvonne, right? And Texas was forced by law to take Yvonne's high school A at face value, exactly what Mitch Daniels said it shouldn't do. It was forced by law to ignore her 22 on the ACT, and it did what he warned was a serious disservice to Yvonne. It admitted her and enrolled her in a calculus course that was arguably beyond her capabilities. And she did struggle, and it was hard. But then she worked hard, and she showed grit and perseverance, and she figured out how to get help, and she succeeded. So at many institutions, the guiding principle is that some kids just can't succeed in college, and you can identify them by their test scores. So it's okay that we have a two-tier higher education system because we live in a two-tier world. But what struck me about being in Uri Treisman's calculus class was that it felt not like a two-tier world. It felt like everyone was in this together. The students seemed to feel like they were part of something that was bigger than themselves, bigger than calculus, that Texas had chosen them to be there, and that their families had sent them there with all their hopes and dreams, and that now they had this responsibility to their families and to their state and even to their country to learn and succeed and to repay that debt. And in earlier eras, that was the way a lot of Americans thought about higher education. Americans took as an article of faith this simple idea that our collective public education benefits us all. We believed that it was simply better to live in a community or in a nation where opportunity through higher education was shared widely. But not today. I think we have in recent decades changed the way we see a college education, not as a collective good that benefits everybody, but as a consumer good or even a luxury good that just benefits us. I think that's part of why we have, as a nation, cut public funding for higher education by such a huge amounts in almost every state in the nation just in the last two decades. Just since 2001, on average, public funding for higher education is down 16% per student at a moment when all the signs in the economy point in the opposite direction, and every other developed and developing country is investing more and more in their young people and higher education. So for a little perspective, I want to, before I go to the questions, to your questions, I want to tell you about one more student who I talked to during my reporting about his college experience. In certain ways, he was a lot like Yvonne. He was the child of immigrants. He grew up in a low-income, working-class family surrounded in his neighborhood by people who didn't go to college. So he had a lot in common with Yvonne, but he had one thing that was very different, which is that she, when I met her, was 18, and he, when I met him, was 93. His name was Patrick Fay, and I went to see him at his retirement home in Connecticut. And Patrick Fay grew up in a small town just outside of Boston, and as a kid, he really wanted to go to college, but he was from this working-class family. His dad was a factory worker and then a dock worker, and at that moment in history, working-class kids like him just never went to college. His family couldn't afford it, and they didn't think it would make any sense for him anyway. And so instead, he and a lot of his friends went off to war. So after Pearl Harbor, he and four of his buddies volunteered, enrolled in the Army. He went off to fight in Europe right after D-Day. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He was shot in the hand by a German sniper, evacuated to Paris, spent a couple of months in a hospital there, and then came back to the front just in time to help liberate Berlin from the Nazis. And then he and millions of other GIs were sent home. And his last stop before going home to his little town outside Boston was an army base in Massachusetts, where he and thousands of other GIs were sat down in this tent and they were told, there's this new thing called the GI Bill. The federal government has decided that if you want to go to college, we will pay. We will pay for 4 years of college. And this was the opportunity that Patrick Fay had been waiting for. He immediately enrolled in Northeastern. He studied chemistry. He did 4 years. He got his BA. Then he went back and got his MA on the GI Bill, went into a long career in chemical engineering, married his high school sweetheart, had six kids, and they all went to college. They all, in fact, got graduate degrees. He told me that he had been to the college graduations of each one of his grandchildren. And he said now he knew he wouldn't be around for his great-grandchildren's college graduations, but he knew they would all be fine. So for Patrick Fay, higher education worked exactly the way we want it to. It was the perfect engine of social mobility. You know, his father was a farmer. His grandfather was a farmer. His father was a factory worker. His children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are all comfortable and well-educated. And he was the hinge in his family story. And the GI Bill was the hinge in his story and in the story of so much of American life during that era. So after I met Patrick Fay, I had sort of known the basic outlines of the GI Bill story, but I wanted to go back and learn more. So I went and read a bunch of histories of that era, and there were two things I discovered that I hadn't known before. One was that when Congress was debating the GI Bill back in 1943, most of the members of Congress didn't actually think that anyone was going to take them up on this offer. They were like, okay, it's fine. We can offer 4 years of college. No one's actually going to show up. Because at the time, only about 10% of Americans were going to college, and it was mostly, you know, wealthy white guys from prep schools in the Northeast. Working class kids just never went to college, and most of the GIs were the children of farmers, they were the children of manual laborers, and the idea that these guys would want to go to college, let alone be able to succeed there, seemed really foreign. And then the second thing was that in early 1945, as the war was starting to wind down, there was this chorus of concern that started to be heard. People saying like, well, wait, what if these guys actually do show up on our college campuses? We got to put a stop to this. And the two leading voices in this chorus were two college presidents, the president of Harvard and the president of the University of Chicago. And they were both writing essays saying, like, we've got to put a stop to this GI Bill. At the very least, we've got to put a test in place, something that will separate the truly worthy students from the unworthy ones. The president of the University of Chicago wrote one article in which he said, if we let all these working class guys into our colleges, we'll have educational hobo jungles on our campuses. And so in some ways, these two guys were right. The GIs really did take the government and the country up on the offer in the GI Bill. In just a few years, the undergraduate student population in the United States doubled. But they were wrong about one critical thing, which was these GIs did not fail in college. In fact, they did great. Their graduation rates, their GPAs were higher in many cases than the students who had been there before the war. So there are a lot of people today who think like those college presidents, and Mitch Daniels, another college president, is one of them. You know, another college president trying to hold back the gates of college against the uneducated invaders. People remain skeptical that students like Yvonne can really succeed. But young people like Yvonne Martinez and professors like Uri Treisman and administrators like David Lotti are trying to tell us a more hopeful story about higher education. They're trying to remind us of the radical potential of unlikely college students. And they're trying to remind us of that great American truth that our collective public education benefits us all.